Blog Talk Radio.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Your guy's been running a positive campaign. That's not accurate. In fact, I have to call you on this, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Oh,
you've been
Lord.
Suggesting that somehow Obama's been running a negative campaign, and your guy's been running a positive campaign. That's not accurate. In fact, that they both stopped all the negative, I'm not sure who would win, but they've both been negative. That cheap shot about, I don't have a problem with my birth certificate, was awful. It is an embarrassment to your party to play that card. This stuff about getting rid of the work requirement for help for welfare is dishonest. Everyone's pointed out it's dishonest. And you are playing that little ethnic card there. And you can play your games and giggle about it.
Well,
but the fact is your side is playing that card.
Okay, well,
when you start talking about work requirements, you know what game you're playing. And everybody knows what game you're playing. It's a race card. And this thing about a birth, if your name's Romney. Yeah, you were well born. You went to prep school. Yeah, brag about it. And this guy has an African name and he's got to live with it. Look who's going further in your life. Just a minute.
You really
who was born on third base?
Wait,
making fun of the guy's birth certificate issue when it was never a real issue, except from the right wing.
You think Mitt Romney's playing the race card?
When he said, when he played
the race card,
there's no doubt he did with his birth certificate.
No doubt.
Why would he bring it up? Why would he say I have no problem with my birth certificate? What's that supposed
because
to say?
Because he's an awkward joker.
Because he misfired badly on the joke.
Why would he do it?
Well, I'm just asking you. Do you think that Mitt Romney is playing the race card?
Oh, now and yeah.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah. And I think this work requirement fits right into it.
That's the race card too, huh?
Of course it is. Welfare. Food stamps.
Well, I mean, I'm happy. Chris,
right.
Absolutely.
I'm happy.
You can chuckle about
well, now
it,
let him respond,
Mr. Chairman, because
yeah,
you have to flag this issue.
No, the fact is, you know what's going on.
Okay, let him
respond.
Well, you got your monologue in, so congratulations. You know, you're loaded up. You got it out.
Well, you from the beginning this morning began the negativity on Obama.
The fact of the matter is that he's from Michigan. He was born in Michigan.
Yeah.
He's making the point that I was born in Michigan. And you know what? We've gotten to a place in politics that any moment of levity is totally frowned upon by guys like you just so that you can, you know, push your brand. You know what? Good for you. It's a moment of levity. Everybody gets it. Barack Obama came out at the correspondence dinner with his own joke, as you remember a couple years ago, playing the Hulk Hogan song, I'm a Real American. Every person, myself, starting in February of last year, as soon as I became chairman of the RNC, Mitt Romney continuously has said, this president was born in this country. It's a non-starter.
Right.
It's a dumb issue. It's a distraction. Forget about it.
It seems funny that the
garbage.
First joke he's ever told in his life was about Obama's birth certificate.
I disagree with Chris on this. I think it was a demonstration of his awkward sense of humor, but I do think, in fairness, that all during the Republican debates and the primaries, that there was a lot of stuff aimed at the president that was not refuted by leaders of the party.
I bet you 20 times on TV.
I'm not talking about the birthing thing as much as I am about he's a Muslim, he's a socialist, he's not American. John Sununu had to apologize for saying he doesn't know what it's like to be an American. That was a pretty tough attack. Now, I think it comes the other way, by the way, from the Democrats toward the Republicans as well. And I think that's what's made the country fed up with American politics, and it's a challenge for both parties.
I think Obama's policies have created a sense that, for whatever reason, he's looking to guidance as far as health care is concerned, as far as our spending is concerned, as far as these stimulus packages are concerned. He's looking to Europe for guidance.
What?
mean, that's the problem.
Where
we've got a government. We've got a government.
Insane. You mean
got
the government fiscal policy
that is
somehow
so far out of control.
You mean the fact that every president we've had has tried to offset the economic cycle with stimulus going the other direction?
Look at the
somehow European.
He said he'd get the debt under control. Where are
well,
we at?
What's that do with
president?
Europe and this foreignization of the guy?
Well,
you're doing it again now.
So you don't think Obama is
influenced by foreign influences?
Okay. So you don't think
you're playing that card
taking
again?
Over health care?
What's this European thing of yours?
Okay.
What do you think?
Let's just work on town. Go ahead, Brian.
What are you up to with this
country?
Chris, let him answer the question.
Not really domestic. Oh, he brought it up.
All right.
Okay.
You don't think that the takeover of our health care system called Obamacare is a problem for most Americans
in this
country?
Let me tell you some history, sir. Teddy Roosevelt pushed for that. Franklin Roosevelt pushed for that. Truman pushed for that. Were they all under the influence of Europe?
I'm not
going to
get into a shouting match with Chris, so you guys can move on.
But you're losing, that's why.
No, it's not losing.
All right.
I'm not going to sit here.
All right, let's
Obama being a foreigner is the thing your party's been pushing. Sununu pushed it. Everybody pushes it, your party.
Okay.
Garbage.
Jokes.
Garbage.
It's your garbage.
Yeah.
Boy, you know, I hear the hurricane. It might bypass us completely and actually go up to New Orleans.
We went from a tropical storm to hurricane three here in about.
Yeah. All right. It's all good right. That maybe we suspend things momentarily. Ryan Priebus, thank you so
all right.
much.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is September. I have my microphone up. This is September the 5th, 3 p.m., and this is the last word. I'm Michael Lawson, and I'm here with our senior producer, Thomas Fortenberry.
Hello, Michael.
Who just beat the police down South Boulevard and got here in time. I'm
well,
right here on time
a
myself.
Busy, busy week, Michael.
I'm telling you. Do you know that Rince Priebus, it's pronounced Rince Priebus, as Rachel says.
Like a rinse cycle?
No, like a Gestapo agent.
Rince.
Anyway, he's saying, denying, you know, the whole thing you have to deny. Deny. Don't believe your lying ears because they are lying to you. Don't believe that lying video that has you saying what you're saying, and then you deny it. These people are the consummate liars. But you know what? They got this all from Mitt Romney. I don't even think these regressive guys were as bad at lying until they met Mitt Romney, because they never boxed themselves in like this. Mitt Romney has been lying since the day he was born. Can you imagine? We were talking about that last night. We went to the hotel, I can't remember the name. It'll come to me. Anyway, we went there last night to the Congressional Black Caucus. It was the Congressional Black Caucus affair. And I want to tell you, it is so outrageous what this man has said. They played a video of him where he was running for governor, where he said that he was going to be more liberal with gay marriage than Ted Kennedy. We saw him. It came out of his mouth. It wasn't dubbed. He said that he would be more liberal on marriage equality than Ted Kennedy. He said that he would get the health care bill through without Ted Kennedy. This is a man. Now he says, when he was running for the presidency, he says he was a very, very severe conservative. Well, they were fourth in education when he took over. They're now 47th when he left office.
Right.
Deval Patrick came back and he redid everything to bring Massachusetts back.
Yeah, they also left that gaping deficit just like they did with the nation.
Oh, you mean? This is the thing. I was trying to tell this to someone. My cousin-in-law, Gary Dent, who should be listening, he said he would call in. I told him that I would give him a break if he called in. I told him that the Mitt Romney, how he made every dime is through deficits. He would come into a company. If the company – now, listen, you have to look at the film Wall Street with Michael Douglas. Michael Douglas says, we look at a company in Wall Street as Gordon Gekko. We look at a company. If they have more assets in their 401ks and their pension plans, we go in and we seize those 401ks and pension plans. And then we tell the people, we can get you a larger – loan, we will get you so you can expand. So what do these people have to do when they take their pension plans and then they get them a bridge loan? Nothing comes out of Bain Capital. They create debt.
Right.
They create debt for that company. And they take out of the pension plan because that's part of their agreement. They take out of the pension plans, they take out of the 401ks, and that goes in their pocket.
The company attracted.
What's he made to make the company attracted.
Would
you don't have
savings.
That's right.
Would
you don't?
That
that's right. You take that. So now everybody will give them a loan, but they have to now lay off people, and now they can't afford it. We're going to play in a little while a young lady that we met. I believe it was Monday. Well, it was a Sunday that we were down there for the march. I don't know. Days run into one month.
Yeah, Sunday we were at one march.
Well, that was the Occupy. Well, she was with
Monday.
The United Workers.
You are live. Live on top of live. Because technology is your friend, Mike.
Okay. We're back on. We were off here. You might have been hearing us, but we couldn't hear any signal coming in. So I hope you heard all that advertising
we were
doing. I mean, we did a lot of it here.
Well, look,
anyway.
Cool. I had to leave.
Cool Charlie had to leave.
He said he will definitely hook everyone up with T-shirts. He's got fantastic quality, by the way. I mean, this
6 mil, right?
Yeah, this was heavy-duty stuff. 100% cotton. It doesn't shrink. It doesn't fade. A lot better than half the stuff we've been running over in the street.
Now,
stuff.
I had these in 2008. I bought 4 of these T-shirts. And the quality now is like 10 times better. Now, the quality I had, I still have them. And I've washed them and washed them and washed them, and they have not faded. This one is almost like it's 3D. So it is really a great quality shirt. And whoever was on the line, please call back in. Don't know what happened,
yep.
But we're here.
We dropped signal, came back, but we're back.
We're back.
So yeah. Here goes something, Mike. Just want to talk about downtown. We've got so much stuff going on. We were talking about dropping signals. No, I think it's because we have half the world parked downstairs. We've got, 15,000 reporters here. That's just the press.
That's just the press.
We've got how many in attendance? 30,000?
About 20,000 credentialed people.
Credentialed. So that's just the serious
right.
Mainstay show. Then you've got the public.
The Rush Limbaughs and the retread and regressive party is saying why they have canceled the stadium is bull. They have 19,000 people on the waiting list to get credentials to come into any event. Forget not alone just the stadium.
Oh, we've got so many. They filled the stadium already, and then they've got 19,000 on hold to get in.
Right.
What has happened is torrential downpours. That's what's happened.
Oh, man, it rained so hard. Yesterday. As a matter of fact, it rained up to at the still can't think of the hotel's name. Ritz-Carlton.
Yep.
That's where we were last night. The Congressional Black Caucus had a big affair down there for all credentialed people and special invitees. And I was invited, and I'm telling you, it was fabulous. The people didn't get there until 11:30. I didn't get there till 11 o'clock. Because I was waiting for someone coming from Wake County, which is about 2 hours the way, but the rain was so bad.
2 hours in the drive.
No, that's in the drive. It took them 3 hours to get there. And then when we got downtown, we had to maneuver all through
all the security.
The security. And then if you went down one street, you not only had to get your whole car, if you were driving, had to go through security with dogs. So sniffing dogs.
That's quite fun.
And now they didn't have that with Mitt Romney and his and Eddie Munster because actually they're not the president.
Actually, they did.
Well,
we had somebody talking about that just the other day about the security state that's going on because sadly enough, it has been noted on both these conventions that they have more police force than they do human beings apparently on the earth because it's been insane. It really has. But. It's on the side of, you know, caution. It's better to be safe than sorry. And so, they're, you know, when you see 20,000 police lining the streets for a parade, you know, well, they're just there in case. Now, luckily, we haven't had anything go wrong, but in case something goes wrong.
Am I off the air again? I don't know if I'm off the air.
Maybe on, off, on.
Why don't you call into the show and see if I'm off the air?
All right. Hold on 1 second.
Because I think we're off again. This thing is dropping like a... this thing is dropping like it's going out of style. Okay? So we're going to call back in. I hope you all are there if you can hear me. But this is just ludicrous. Because we are losing the signal on this end. And the last time this happened is because of thunderstorms. So I have no idea. Okay, so we still must be on the air. Okay. That's me. Is that you calling? Yeah. I see you up here.
Okay. Well,
so can you listen? Call in. Speak.
Hey, Mike.
Okay,
you're there. Bye. We are running a test. Because it was
that it could we could tell. All right.
Very strange.
It's very strange because I lost my according to this, it shows me that I'm not on line. So, you know, it goes back and forth. I have no idea what's going on here. But anyway,
this is par for the course. We've been down there. We've had a few technical difficulties, including the weather.
Mm-hmm.
We've had. One of the sad things I saw last night, I went in and out of the arena twice to go get food and do other things, and I got caught in the torrential downpour a couple of times. I don't mind it. You know, I'm from Mississippi.
You're from Mississippi?
Yeah, we live in the tropics down there, and rain is an everyday affair. So it didn't bother me a bit. But the thing that made me sad was going through the security checkpoints.
Right.
You know, it's like the airport. You have to shuffle along. They got everything you own, put it in a tray, go through x-ray machines, you know, have the dogs lick your face. And the poor lady,
did they have pork?
The poor gentleman that were showing up in this pouring rain with very nice umbrellas had to leave them off. They wouldn't allow any metal umbrellas in the stadium.
Yeah.
So the sad thing was they were piling them in the street. And that's what I went through. It was over 3 feet high, just a stack of umbrellas over there. And these people were fighting and arguing because some of them were their nice personal ones, not just the little disposable ones. But I just thought it was, you know, it's a sad state of affairs in America when we have to be fearful of the crazies. Because you never know. I mean, we can't even go to watch a movie.
But ever since Ronald Reagan came in, we have been told we need to be afraid. What's that? Be afraid. Be very afraid. What was the film that said that? That was Be Afraid. Was that Vendetta?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
Okay.
It is a state of fear, though. But it. Hey, you know what? Speaking of fear,
yes.
You want to mention these undocumented workers that tried to go and get themselves.
Let's talk about that.
Okay. So our good friend Roxana that we had on last week. She was leading a group of undocumented workers that were coming up visiting from Texas, been going across the entire nation. We talked about that last week. But yesterday, decided to go downtown, staged a protest. They sat down in the middle of the street and then refused to move until the police arrested them and forcibly removed them. They did this simply to get attention. You know, they were released 15 minutes later at the police station. But I want y'all to go
check. It took them a half hour to get to the police
station. Oh, yeah. That's through the traffic. But they are part of nopapersnofear.org. O-R-G.
Okay.
They have the reasons that they're doing this. They have pictures of the events. You should go down there and check it out. They gave a press conference today on corner of 5th and College at noon. But for all of those of you that couldn't attend around the world, you can certainly go check it out and see what they're doing, because these are important issues. I mean, this is one of the reasons we had last night that fantastic speech by Mayor Castro. That knocked it out of the park.
We're going to get to the speeches. Don't ruin the thing here. We're going to get to the speeches.
We're going to get to the speeches. I just wanted to mention these guys here. Nopapersnofear.org. They're just trying to, as they say, bring people out of the shadows. You know, give everyone a chance. These people have been over here working hard.
Right.
They're not doing anything wrong.
Right.
All they want is a chance.
Right.
So they took a chance, staged a protest, and it turned out to be the largest arrest of the entire convention so far, because we've had a very peaceful convention. Hadn't been any problems.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like Chicago.
Oh, no. Or that, Freedom Cage at Denver.
Well, and the young lady's name is Roxana.
Yeah, she's just, you remember Roxana from last, she organizes, I think, a lot of groups. She's kind of a,
We had her on the show. Didn't we have her on the show?
Yeah, we had her. Yeah, she was here with her little group, but she has her own group, and then she also helps organize groups. This other group is not hers, but she was the one, had them on the bus with her, if you remember the bus.
Yeah.
But it was nopapersnofear.org. That's the guys, if you want to check it out.
So go to
nopapersnofear.org.
Go there and check it out. Now, I'm going to play you a short interview here. Well, it's about 5 minutes long.
Okay.
As with a young lady named Kelly Harrison, who's from Eureka, Illinois, and she is with the UAW.
Hey, we gotta get his back.
Okay, this is September 2nd, 2012. This is The Last Word, Michael Lawson, and we have a young lady here from
Eureka, Illinois.
Where?
Eureka, Illinois.
Eureka. Oh, there's a sci-fi
show. Oh, this is definitely in Illinois, so it's not
there.
No, that's not where I'm from.
Now, I know you were in
Wow. That's right.
And it's the union label.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm an auto worker.
You're an auto worker. And where did you work at?
I work at Mitsubishi Motors in Bloomington, Illinois.
Now, Mitsubishi, when did that plant first start up?
1988. I started in
89. Okay. And has it ever had a lull or anything?
Well, we're in a lull right now. We're down to one shift, and we're building the Outlander Sport. We used to build 6 models at one time, and now we're down to 1.
What's the prospect? Any prospect?
Yeah, well, I think there's some future, in that plant for us. We took a pay decrease several years ago, during our contract, so our plant would stay open.
So you mean labor does try to work to keep the business going?
Absolutely. We want our jobs, too, and we are the only organized transplant in the United States.
Yeah, because I understand, where was it they wanted to move... Progressive Party wanted to move, protesting a plant down south here that they didn't want union workers in. I think it was a Chrysler or a plant that they didn't want it to open because they didn't want union labor.
Well, yeah, they can keep preaching that all they want, but they get good quality cars out of union labor.
Absolutely. And so how much of an increase did you take?
We took a $5 an hour cut in pay.
$5?
Yep.
Anything in the 401k range?
Oh, they don't match our 401k anymore. We took a big hit on our contract, so that we could stay open, which was something we had to do. We needed to do it. We needed to keep cars building and, being built in Illinois.
And you also needed to have people work.
And we need good union jobs. Good union jobs.
That is a Japanese car.
Yep.
And how did that come pass about that you started building Japanese cars?
Well, when they first started in 88, the union was just in the process of getting organized when I got hired in there. So I know we started out like at $9 an hour when it wasn't union yet. But once the union got in there, of course, our pay increased and our benefits increased, and people started building in the community, started buying, the house market, increased, and it's good for the community.
Right.
Oh my. 3 years or back in, let's see, we took, it was laid off 6 years ago. I believe we had almost 3,000 workers. Now we're down to 1,000. Yeah. And we're doing more work. You know, we still got, yeah. You know, that's like they want us to work until we're 70 years old, you know. And to me, I can't. Not at what I do every day. I mean, I had this discussion with Aaron Schock in his office, so he's my representative. And of course, you know, the Republican way is to, you know, how to save Social Security is to. Okay, the regressive or the other view, they think that we should work till we're 70 years old, but we're working more efficient now than they ever have in this country. And we can't work till we're 70 years old doing the kind of work that we do, because we're in and out of a car. I mean, at one time, it was every 60 seconds we built a car. Every 60 seconds. We're building 600 cars a shift.
Now,
that comes, we used to stamp the car, you know, in-house, and then we painted it, went all the way through the whole system. And, yeah, the high speed was 60 seconds. Yeah. Oh, it was 2 minutes or something. A lot of it was manual. Of course, we've gone back to a lot of manual building the cars today because it's a cheaper way to build it. But they're moving as they build the car, you know, they start bringing more robots, you know, so that they can move it faster.
No,
because of working more efficiently, they lay them off. They don't need it anymore. We're done for shifts. Until we're done building. All right, so you're 50 or you take an early retirement at 55 or so, then they'll move us on and then they like a two-tier wage system, you know? They probably want to bring people in behind us at a lower scale. Yeah, well, I'm totally against that two-tier wage system. I think that's just the pay out for us, the gender inequality, you know, because I think you're doing the same job regardless of, you know, race, color, gender, whatever, installment. I'm local 2488, UAW.
Okay.
That's mind blowing, isn't it, Michael?
This
car every 60.
Yeah, and this was not a setup. We were standing on Trade Street, and
just
waiting for the Occupy protest to come by. And I said, "Well, let me just interview some people that were standing on the street." And she was wearing this T-shirt that said UAW on it. I didn't realize that Thomas saw it, and I walked over to her, and there was a worker, union worker from Local 24 in Illinois, who took a $5 an hour pay cut.
Yeah.
Not $5 a week, $5 an hour pay cut.
And then, if you notice, they also said they lost their pension.
They have no pension.
401k.
They lost their 401k, but they needed a job.
And they, as you said, did it to keep those jobs in Illinois.
To keep those jobs in Illinois.
But that's,
this is just mind blowing. We have need to put on.
You know, it is. It what I think was amazing about that.
Mm-hmm.
Robots have made it so efficient
right.
They can fire the workers.
Right.
As you said, they went from six shifts down to one because of efficiency.
Right.
But then, in order to save even more money, did you hear, they've got them working so efficiently now
right.
on the line that they quit using the robots because it's more expensive.
That's
and
right.
It's easier to do it manually.
And here's the other thing.
And I just said, boy,
they're working. Okay. They're working 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
They're advertised, here they are doing a job, and they're doing 60 seconds, they're building a car.
It's just insane. And they're building.
That means that she said out the door, paint everything, yep. 60 seconds.
From stamping the steel all the way through to driving it away. That's just unbelievable.
I mean,
some of our companies say that, you know, they could squeeze some more blood out of those workers. I mean, are you kidding me?
Holy cow. I have never heard of such a thing in my life. This is just completely outrageous.
The thing I loved about that, though, was that vicious cycle of you bring in machinery, you do everything you can, you tweak the work atmosphere to make it more efficient. You get it down to a science so that you can start laying off all those pesky workers that are costing you money because you're saving the money with all the machinery you bring in. And then you get the few remaining workers working so furiously that they become more efficient than machines. You get rid of machines too. I mean, you got rid of everything. And now what do? You just roll around on the property.
On the property.
What a model of business, huh?
I'm telling you. We have, again, and we're going to go through this again, because I'm telling you, you guys need to come down here and get the Obama T-shirts. Thomas,
all right.
Take it with Cool Charlie.
Well, I'll tell you what. Cool. While you're here again, we'll talk to you real quick. One thing that impressed us about
and I just want to say, Michael, we'll be with you in a minute.
These shirts, I remember these when he actually first ran. We had incredible wear out of these things. The guys that I see downtown right now, they are selling these, Walmart rag T-shirts that are disintegrating on the rack while they're holding them up. Yep. Well, hold on 1 second. I'm going to grab this mic for you. I wanted you to talk about a little bit about the quality and all, because these shirts are incredible. They look incredible. They feel incredible. And better than that, the ones we had from 4 years ago, no wear at all. No, even fade, nothing. And I want you to talk about that for a second.
Thank you. Well, this is Cool Charlie again, and to tell you a little bit about this shirt, this is the same one that we sold back in 2008 when President Obama first ran for the office. It's a top-quality shirt. It's 100% cotton. If you know anything about the mill, it's a 6.1. It washes very well. We suggest just wash it in cold and just hang it up, and 4 years from now, it'll be just as good today. And again, in 4 years, it'll be the same shirt again. Take care of it like that.
Well, I take mine to the cleaners. I don't wash it.
Well, you could dry clean it. Why not?
Yeah. Then it lasts longer, right?
But I have a washing machine at home. So.
Well, I got a washing machine at home, but I take it to the cleaners. Because I didn't want anything to happen to it. You know.
And if you'd like to know where you can find this shirt, Redhead 28, where it's being broadcast now, you can find this shirt anywhere from small to extra large for $15 or two for $25. And if you're a little larger and you want a 2X or 3X, they're available for $15 each.
As I said before, Pillsbury Doughboy, Chris Christie. You don't have anything for him.
I don't think so today, no.
No,
I don't think we have anything for him today.
Okay.
So, listen, you can find this shirt again at Reddit 28th, and we're also located outside in a little booth, 28th and Davidson. You can see us from the street as you go by. So, again, come on up at Reddit 28 and enjoy it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael, are you there?
I'm here. Good afternoon.
Well, we've had drop calls. Skype has dropped. Blog Talk has dropped, I mean, twice already. I mean, give me a break. What's this? We being zapped by the Secret Service or what?
I think it's just being overwhelmed. We've got so much going on in this city. I think all the networks are bogging down. It's kind of like trying to charge my phone at the stadium last night, and it took, what, an hour and 15 minutes just to get 23%?
What?
It was horrible. It was horrible. Yeah. I could have just written a letter home, mailed it, and it gotten there before then.
Well, we have another little thing that I'd like to play for some of the people listening, and this is a short one. One of the people on the street we just happen to be passing by. Let me start it over here because I don't have the volume up. That needs to be done. Okay.
This is September the 2nd, The Last Word, 2012. We're here with Mr. Bud Barrow of Charlotte, North Carolina, who does what?
I'm the director for the Piedmont office for the Office of the Governor of North Carolina.
And, Bud, what are you doing out here today? I don't see any tags on you. What's the story here?
I'm working for the governor. I'm delivering some messages she has for various people that are coming into town to visit that she wants to make sure she connects with.
Okay, so since everybody knows you, I guess you don't need to be have identifying tags.
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, you have something that lets you into the convention center. I'm not going to be able to get into the convention center.
Oh, please. You're right for the governor. What do you mean? You can't get in.
No, I need the same tags as you guys.
Oh,
I'm just a civilian out here.
So what
enjoying
it. How do you think this has been shaping up so far?
When you say this, you mean?
The convention here at Charlotte.
I think.
First time?
It's been first time for a convention of the Democratic National Convention, but not for the first time for a large convention in
right.
Charlotte.
Nothing this big,
that's absolutely right, but Charlotte is well prepared, as you can see as you look around you. We're having decent weather, and we've got people coming in from all over the world. I just did an interview with a French television station a couple of hours ago at our delegation's hotel. So it's very exciting, and there's going to be a lot of exciting messages and themes that are going to be talked about at this convention.
How many people do you think they are expecting to enter Charlotte?
I've seen media reports that and again, I don't want to be, I'd rather someone go to the source material, but I've heard numbers of 20 to 30,000, which includes everybody.
Right.
It includes journalists, visitors, people directly associated with the convention, people that are involved with other activities surrounding the convention, law enforcement, other support personnel.
Why? Because I know, I think there's like 5,000 press or 6,000, 7,000. I
understood that they were expecting more than that. I'm not sure. I don't know what the numbers are in terms of people actually registering at this point.
Well, I want to tell you, they got new bikes for the police out here. This is pretty absolutely fabulous. I don't know if you got that contract, but that was a good contract.
Well, as you know, the city, both Tampa and Charlotte, did get grants of $50 million each because the convention's recognized as an extraordinary event from a Homeland Security standpoint, and that put in motion a process that allowed both cities to incur expenses up to $50 million for things like the equipment that you're seeing. I believe it also includes compensation for extra law enforcement officers. And what's good for Charlotte is that some of the things the money's being spent on will stay here. So for the police and some of the other infrastructure of the city, these will be some improvements that we'll be able to keep as part of the legacy of the convention.
But who picked that money? Where did that money come from?
Ultimately, the money comes from the federal government, and I believe there's actually a congressional appropriation involved, and so then it goes from the federal government on down to some combination of the state and then to the city.
So you mean the Progressive Party in Washington gave us the same amount as they gave to the people in Tampa?
Well, I do believe that there's a historical precedent with both conventions, because both, you know, the conventions are viewed as an opportunity for everybody, an economic development opportunity.
The last convention we saw last week, it's not for everybody. So what did they?
I meant this convention.
Oh, right.
I meant, sorry,
this,
these conventions, right. Meaning the Democratic Republican convention. And so I think there's been a spirit of equanimity in terms of allocating resources. And also the practical aspect is they are major, significant events. They do involve security issues, logistical issues, and everybody wants to be here.
Okay.
Thank you very much. You're doing a good job. Enjoy. Okay.
Okay, that was Bud Barrow, who is the...
This is September the 2nd.
That was Bud Barrow, who is the... works out of the governor's office. And he was telling us a little bit about what was going on with the convention. And we dropped Michael Evans again. I'm telling you, he was dropped again, Mike Evans. Yeah. So, but right now we have a gentleman in with us named Christian Snyder. Well, realistically, we found him wandering aimlessly along the light rail tracks. And we felt sorry for him, so we tell him to come in here. There's a nice French bakery, Amelie's, and, you know. He said the coffee was not strong enough. He said it wasn't. I said, I got gasoline in the car. You want that? No, but, you know.
It's always a pleasure to be back, Michael.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, huh? And now you're located for the time being out on the left coast.
That's correct.
Doing what?
I'm a political consultant out there.
A political consultant. That means you're a saboteur.
No, saboteur, operative.
Operative.
It's all
operative.
It's all relative.
Like Secret Service and whatnot. Political consultants, they sabotage their opponents by digging up the truth about them.
I like to think that I empower people.
You empower people.
You know, give them the organizational tools to have their voices heard in their community.
The voices heard in their community.
Yeah. So. I'm working on a couple of different projects out in California right now. I've had the rare opportunity and the honor of meeting Dolores Huerta last night. Who is a civil rights activist from the 70s, started the UFW with Cesar Chavez, was married to Cesar Chavez's husband, who just passed away 2 years ago, and she just received the Presidential Medal of Honor from Obama, one of the few recipients of such an honor, and Dolores is about 82 years old and kept me out to about 3 in the morning dancing.
Please, I saw her last night on the dance floor. She came on the floor. I didn't see her leave.
No. She did
I
not.
Had 3 drinks. She was still dancing.
Yeah.
You know what it is?
And that had started.
I thought she was drunk, but she wasn't.
No.
She went right past the bar and right out there. Oh, my God. She was smoking everybody on the floor, and she's 82.
Mm-hmm. 82 years old, non-stop. We were at a party before that. She made me do the YMCA. I was pretty exhausted, and she's an amazing woman, and she has a lot of amazing people around her as well.
Well, the young lady we met, Justine? No, what was the young lady? Melissa. Melissa.
San Miguel.
San Miguel, right. Sam, you know, I meant to ask her about that because San Miguel was the best beer I've ever drank, ever. It's Philippines. You got San Miguel in the Philippines. You got San Miguel Philippines and San Miguel Manila. Well, that's another story. Go ahead.
I believe she's from her family's from Peru. I'm not sure. You'll have to ask her. But she has a pretty amazing story.
Mm-hmm.
She's an at-large delegate for the state of California. So it's an appointed position, and it's
gorgeous girl. Gorgeous girl.
She's done numerous interviews.
And she said she was dragging because she was tied to the hip with
Dolores Huerta.
That's right. She says she won't stop. She won't stop. She won't stop. Yeah. Will stop her? Will somebody stop her? I can't keep up.
Well, this is 26. And yeah. She's like, oh my Lord, yes. I don't know if I can do this.
It's unbelievable. And she's going to try to call in, right?
Melissa should be calling in about 4:30.
Okay.
A couple of meetings came up that she had to take. You also have, I believe, Assemblyman Mark Cohen.
Right.
Calling in around 4:15.
Right.
He's the longest serving assembly member in Pennsylvania. I believe he was elected in 1970.
And he was the majority whip in 1992 to 1994.
He's a wonderful progressive voice in the Pennsylvania legislature.
1974, he was elected.
1970, so the year I was born, he started serving.
So last night on the light rail, going home late at night with all those crowds, I accidentally got squished against 2 mayors from Pennsylvania.
2 mayors? You mean
2 mayors. No,
oh,
no.
Oh, okay.
Mayors.
Okay, mayors.
Yeah. It was quite funny, though, because they were asking me what we thought of the convention, what we thought of the speakers, who do we like best, blah, blah, blah. But funny thing was they started comparing and contrasting it to what happened with the RNC. And it was quite illuminating because when they got to Chris Christie, they both said, and I won't name them here because they were explicit about that, not doing so, but they said they knew him, they had met him multiple times. And it was the most awkwardly funny conversation about Sopranos style life that I've ever had, I have to say.
Well, I also have to give you. give you guys full disclosure.
Yeah,
I guess.
Because he is from New Jersey.
I'm from New Jersey. That's where I was born and raised. I don't have any stories about Chris Christie.
Well, we know that he was thrown out. What was he, a ward person?
Mm-hmm.
He was a which where was he from?
I
think he was the southern part of New Jersey. He was so bad he got slaughtered in his race. We talked about this the other day, and he was nobody. And the only reason why he even got close to being elected is because Corzine was so corrupt. I mean, that's a fact. I mean, well, I say corrupt. He was involved with the shenanigans with the banks and Lehman Brothers and Salomon Brothers and all that.
But
nonsense.
That didn't even come out to after the election.
Yeah, but
it was, it was
people who do.
Right. It was, of course, I was just very disconnected.
Yeah.
And he had a lot of things happen. You know, he got into an accident right before the election.
Speeding, right?
Where the state troopers were going like 100 and some odd miles an hour down the parkway.
Right.
You know, so he... There was a lot of. I mean, it's a heavily Democratic state, and it was just nice instead of having instead of having this billionaire who is detached and really sort of from New York or Manhattan, to have this straight talking sort of gruff guy that you could relate with, who is also an attorney.
I can't relate to him.
You know,
I mean, the man he talks down to everybody.
And welcome to New Jersey.
Yeah.
it's a favorite pastime.
Tony Soprano never talked down to anybody.
Me neither.
Just shot you.
Yeah.
I mean, but he didn't talk down to you while he was shooting you. Well, mm-hmm. Maybe he did while he was shooting you, but not before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this guy, you know, he's a blimp. Well, that's another story. But tell us about your days in Jersey.
My days, I never really worked much in politics in New Jersey. I did run, and I guess you would call it an independent expenditure in California, but a 501c4 in the race, in the governor's race. Didn't go well. It was a tough area. They gave me a very conservative area, and we really wanted to focus in on women's issues because that's primarily where Governor Chris Christie has questionable views.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
If you have any sort of democratic standards in you. That was interesting. I have a good friend. I just came back, and one of the guys I played football with when I was in high school is actually chief of staff for two assembly members. The lead assembly member Ribble and assembly member Angelini.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, everybody in New Jersey tends to be more moderate when it comes to being Republican. Governor Chris Christie is not
a moderate.
Good. He's just not a good representative.
Well, and that's why he will not win re-election if they get somebody to run against him.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was hoping he could hop off and run for vice president. But I think if they show any good sort of a showing in Jersey, he's finished.
Well,
if they get somebody to run.
Well, and that's a good
question. Maybe
he's
you.
Gonna run. It's not. I'm a California resident, but
yeah. But so was Mitt Romney. Was a Utah resident. He ran for governor of Massachusetts. Wow. Well, when's that ever stopped anybody? Please, somebody, please. What's his name? Robert Kennedy. Yeah, he was a Massachusetts resident. Where did he ran in New York?
Mm-hmm.
Come on.
Well,
it's done every day.
I don't have that sort of wealth, Michael.
Oh, well.
I have not accumulated that much so far.
Oh, you can't. Well, you know, the average citizen.
An average show.
Okay, so tell us what you think about last night. The speeches.
I have to say, even as a political consultant, I was really impressed. I mean, just straight up impressed. I could not. Being a member of the press for this convention, got all the speeches beforehand and read them. And I was a little worried. They didn't seem to have a lot of meat to them on paper. You know, it seemed like, I'm like, oh boy, this is going to get rough, you know. And then I couldn't make the connection between what I read and what I was seeing on stage. because they were so electrifying. I mean, I can't think of one speaker that was like a soft spot.
Well, one of the things, I was talking with Mike Evans about this last night, one of the things that really surprised me was the difference between the career politician and the real people, mm-hmm. and some of the unknowns. So you take some of the younger or newer people like Esther with all that, absolutely, like I said, electrifying, unbelievable.
Yeah.
I was just blown away. The charisma just pouring out of the man, right? The mother that got a mother daughter in healthcare. Things like that, so riveting, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then you get people like Cavillius or something like that. You know what to expect.
Right.
You're waiting for, you know, good, substantial, okay, but it was a flatline. I would say those were the ones that were kind of,
yeah, they were solid. And if that's the case, it's not working. That was my next question. If you were going to do that,
say, you know, what was somewhat flat would have got the art. You know, it was,
Well,
I saw Lily Ledbetter. I was in shock. I was in awe.
Well, let me tell you something. Now, I want to give you my impression, because I was in a vehicle waiting for someone to us. We were either going to take my car or we were going to take his car. He was coming in with his wife from Wake County, as we said before. But right. But the thing is that I don't know if the people heard it, because we got cut off like twice off the air on this end anyway. I had to listen to him on Sirius Radio. And I don't know what you were saying before, but I teach media literacy, film and television, and media literacy, critical listening. I felt every single warmth, all the warmth that every one of these individuals wanted to get through. I could feel it. And with Castro, well, it really set the stage with Patrick and Governor Patrick. And if you couldn't get riled up by his speech, you are a Republican. Or dead. Same thing. But after that, and Lily Ledbetter, just like you said, I mean, she is, you know, she has that Alabama twang, which even made it hit home more for people to really understand that she is not a politician. This is something that happened to her, and you can believe it. She was telling from the heart, and it was the grit. And then the thing with the and I understand the young lady, we're talking about the kids. She wrote that, and all they did was the speechwriters downstairs under the stage edited it. They cut pieces out of it because it was too long, but they did not change any words.
No.
All they did was edit it down. This was all her.
Right, and that's also what was interesting, is that when we watched the RNC, you saw them really trying to force a message.
But they all came up with the same message.
Right, and that was the thing. Yeah, they were really trying to, like, women, we love women, we love women, we
yeah.
love women.
They've never said that in their lifetime.
Right.
You've never heard them say that. Yeah, we love women to stay at home, cook, get pregnant, and clean.
And last night, it was people relating experiences.
Absolutely. Real experiences.
Right, and it was emotionally intimate at times.
Right.
When people were just relating, oh, this is what I came through. You saw the same thing at the RNC. A lot of them were like, hey, well, I came from a poor family, and now this is what I want to do. No story, no
right.
real explanation on where their struggle came
But then you
from.
Find out they weren't from a poor family.
Right. It was just like a one-liner they kind of
threw it in.
That if somebody fact-checked, they could say, well, look, I did have somebody poor in my family. So.
Right, right. It was my distant left
right.
cousin on the right coast.
Whereas we heard real stories of struggle and triumph last night, you know.
Well now, see, I missed Amy, Tammy Duckworth. I missed her.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
When I read that,
Well, see, I read her story before, so I know all about it, but I missed her speech.
I wrote a text last night as I was going through this, and, you know, I was reading all the speeches, as I said beforehand, and I was talking to somebody, and I'm like, what do you think of the speeches tonight? And I'm like, they all look a little bit flat, but I would watch Duckworth, because what I've just read, I mean, this is an intense story.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, now, but realistically, I don't know what you were expecting from those other lines. They were not flat. Those storylines that these people had, they might have seemed, because maybe you were actually looking for something that you didn't see, but they
I was looking for policy things and stuff like that and direction, but these were just human stories. You know, it was the experience of what it's like to go through our everyday.
Well, wait a minute. How are you going to say that when Ann Romney said that they used to take an iron board and put it on a box and iron his shirts?
And she had
in a basement.
And she had to eat tuna fish once.
I mean, if you believe that.
I cried.
As Al Sharpton says, I got three bridges to sell you a book.
I cried when she told me that one time in her life she had to eat pasta and tuna fish. I mean,
pasta and tuna. Can you believe that?
Terrible.
Holy cow. I mean, he had to sell some of his stock in order to get a car?
Because
he was walking.
He was in law school and business school at the same exact time.
Oh.
Because they had to get a car big enough for that dog.
Oh, that's right. They had to get right because they couldn't
leave the CMS out.
Yeah, because see, the problem is they could not board the dog.
They couldn't
because they couldn't afford it.
Oh boy.
Yeah, they couldn't board. They couldn't afford to board the dog. It's terrible. But that's right. They bought a kennel for him, put him up on the roof. So that was his boarding. But they see, here's the problem. We had what Castro said last night. That, you know, instead of holding a mop, he's now holding a microphone. I never heard anybody at the RNC said they ever even looked at a mop.
No, I think Marco Rubio.
He looked at a mop?
The best speech of the convention, and he was the one person that got it. And that's the marked difference. Was that you had one person who's like, hey, look, my dad would have been at the back of this room serving your drinks.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that so that I could be in the front of the room talking to you. That hit home. And, you know, I am personally somebody who believes, please don't get upset, but I believe in a strong Republican Party.
Oh, no, you have to. Because if you don't have a strong Republican Party, you have a weak Democratic Party.
Right, and if you don't have a strong Republican Party, then you're seeing what's occurring now, which is extremism, because it's the only way that they can attract any sort of base or activism. Right, and it's by going to the extremes. Instead of having, you know, solid fundamental principles that they believe in, you know, they've had to really delve into some dark corners of our neighbors.
Yeah, we had talked about this the other night, that it's that wrestling world, you know, WWE or whatever this thing is, that to attract attention, you just endlessly get more and more extreme. You start, you know,
yeah,
I'll use a chair. Well, then I'll cut my forehead. Well, then I'll throw a drawer.
And now they've turned into, I don't know if you've ever watched it recently, it's turned into like a soap opera for men. You know, and I remember when I was a kid, right? I mean, we really thought it was real. I remember when Hulk Hogan had to testify that this was actually entertainment.
Right.
It broke our hearts.
It didn't break my heart because I knew it was fake.
Well,
it was fake to me as roller derby, but I liked roller derby.
I had.
Because I liked watching the girls.
I had original pictures of Lou Albano with Cyndi Lauper from WrestleMania 1. That was the coolest thing ever when he had like the rubber band piercing in his face. Oh, there's, yeah. And I also like George Animal Steel. I mean, those guys were fun.
But, you know, I don't know why I couldn't accept that, but I accepted roller derby.
I mean, I thought that was real.
No, I didn't think it was real. I knew it wasn't real. because I started watching my father. He used to say, hey, we watched it because the girls were tough. And they, some were good looking. A lot were good looking. Some looked like wrestlers.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. But I because we used to roller skate. See, in New York City, you don't see people roller skate. They got these blades. That ain't roller skate. That's garbage. We were on roller skate with metal wheels on the street, the cement streets outside, the tar. I mean, we would buy these skates. And, of course, we'd roller skate inside. When you went inside the roller rink, then you had to have those the wooden skates, the wooden wheels. But we'd roller skate, roller derby. We played roller derby out in the street, you know, with the traffic.
Is that what happened to
you, Mike? Yes, that's what happened to me. And as a matter of fact, I'll never forget my first cousin, Mel, who lives in New York now. On July 4th, we were playing roller derby, and Mel flipped upside down and broke his elbow. And he says, look at my elbow. The bone was sticking out. I said, look, I just broke. They took him to the hospital. So that was the last time he got on skates. Yeah, as I said, we won.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing what we used to allow ourselves to do.
But you know, you can't, you don't do this thing because when in the old days, summertime, even the wintertime, you're home from school, the first thing your parents says, fix your chores and get the heck out of the house.
But look, it's one thing when we're talking about kids playing and we're talking about fictitious sports. And all entertainment. When a major party of the United States is reduced to that level, that's the problem.
Yeah,
that's true. Absolutely true.
I would agree with that.
As comparing and contrast, last night's opening salvo, even Michael Steele on MSNBC, he couldn't talk. What happened? Did I lose my daggone? Did we get locked off again? What the heck happened here? Nope, that's the 1, 2, 3. We're up there. Where am I? I can't see the. I don't know what the heck happened here. Well, just a minute.
We're off. So I'm not sure what Michael Steele said.
Okay, we're back up.
Hold on,
Paula.
The,
just a minute, we're right with you.
I really gotta say, I don't know if it was because I got, I accidentally got bumped into by the Reverend Jesse Jackson, which was amazing. It was just like it bumped into me. You know, it was such just an amazing night being in there, and to me the crowd was one of the best parts of it. Just they really were. They were really, really excited. And as I was saying earlier, I don't want to be jaded,
right.
But at times you do get jaded about politics.
Hello, Paula. Who's this?
Hello, Paula.
215. Who's 215?
That's Mark Cohen.
This is Mark Cohen on the phone. Yes.
We're very glad to speak to you. Senator, how are you? How are you enjoying Charlotte?
Very good. Very good. I think the Obama campaign is doing a great job of presenting informed, accurate speakers, both at the convention itself. Everybody who watched last night saw a good number of leading Democrats speak in great detail as to why they were for the president. And beyond the convention floor itself, there are all sorts of caucus meetings going on in which the Obama administration is also supplying excellent speakers and a lot of very detailed material about the achievements of the Obama administration and why people ought to be active in the president's reelection campaign.
Well, I just want to tell you, if we've been dropping calls all day. I mean, this has been happening for the last 3 days. I think it's because there's so many people using their cells downtown now. It's almost impossible. But I'm glad you got through. And you have been a representative since 1974?
That's right. I'm the senior member of the Pennsylvania State Legislature. I've got more seniority in the state legislature than any of the other 252 members of the Pennsylvania legislature.
Where are you from in Pennsylvania?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Well, where are you from in Pennsylvania?
I'm from Philadelphia. I represent the lower northeast section of the city of Philadelphia in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives.
You and Chris Matthews, huh?
That's right. Yes. Chris Matthews and I were both defeated for the same congressional seat in different years. I am losing my race. I got a higher percentage of the vote than Chris did. I run into Chris once every few years, and he needles me that he did almost as well, and he wasn't in elective office like I was, and I was defeated for the Democratic nomination for Congress in 1978. He had been defeated for the Democratic nomination for Congress in 1974.
What's going on now in Pennsylvania with the voter ID?
The voter ID legislation is being challenged on constitutional grounds by a whole lot of people, including myself. The Commonwealth Court judge heard the case and ruled that the law was constitutional. It was not a very strongly written decision. The case is now being appealed to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which is going to hear the case argued by counsel for both sides on September 13th. Governor Corbett had wanted the case not to be heard until the end of October, which would have left very little time for the Supreme Court to act. It also would have kept the federal government out of the matter. The federal government can get involved once the Supreme Court makes a decision. If the Supreme Court decides the wrong way, I would expect the Eric Holder and the Justice Department will be in federal court very quickly. There are six justices on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Three are Democrats, three are Republicans. One of the three Republicans voted with the Democrats earlier this year on validating a legislative redistricting plan that the Senate Democrats were very agitated about. So I think there's certainly a possibility for a 4-2 victory to invalidate the Voter ID Act. I'm sorry.
Is that enough time to get the word out that people have?
I think there is a vigorous grassroots campaign in Philadelphia and many other communities of the state. Philadelphia is a community of the state that's most affected by the Voter ID Act. But many, many organizations, ACLU, NAACP, huge numbers of the Democratic Party officials, huge numbers of churches, huge numbers of neighborhood groups and nonprofit organizations, AARP, among them, are doing everything they can to really make sure the people are aware of the requirements. And many owners of apartment buildings and managers of apartment buildings and senior citizen organizations are doing an outstanding job of making sure that the people whom they're in contact with on a regular basis are fully informed as to the requirements of the voting of the voter ID law, and they're being given the information to go out and get the ID the law requires. It's a dumb law. It's a law designed to stifle voter participation. It's anti-American in the sense that the whole history of the flow of American history has been towards expanding the franchise, and this works to contract the franchise. But people are rising to the challenge.
I was going to say,
and,
do you think
I think there's going to be very high turnout in Pennsylvania, and it may turn out that the voter ID law stimulates turnout. And I know 4 years ago in Indiana passed the voter ID law a lot like Pennsylvania's voter ID law, and Indiana hadn't gone for a Democrat for president since 1964, but Indiana went for Barack Obama in 2008. So in Pennsylvania, Obama won by 750,000. Yeah, I feel pretty confident that he's going to win big this time. Pennsylvania is one of 10 states which is being actively contested, but it's not being as actively contested by either side as other states are. I think there's a general agreement that Pennsylvania is likely to go blue again.
Snyder wants to ask you a question.
No, I was going to ask about the you just answered it. This would actually activate people to as they're already sort of organizing around the idea to make sure that these voter ID laws don't go into effect, that it starts to build maybe sort of new coalitions in activating voters.
I think that's true. We're certainly getting a lot of people active in a manner that helps the Obama campaign who would not normally be activists. They're like not senior citizens, run nonprofit organizations, healthcare organizations,
the people that are
apartment house owners, nonprofit groups that run apartment houses. An awful lot of people who are basically apolitical, and in a few cases Republicans, are doing everything they can to maximize the number of people who show up to vote. They're not taking any position on who anybody ought to vote for, but they're fully aware that the overwhelming majority of the people disenfranchised by the Voter ID Act are Democrats, and that helping people comply with the Voting ID Act certainly aids the Democratic Party and the Obama-Biden campaign in particular.
Absolutely. We were having a conversation before about the speeches last night.
I think Michelle did an absolutely spectacular job. And anybody who missed it and wants to listen to it, I'm sure can find it on YouTube. It was really as intimate a speech as has ever been given by a first lady. It really talked in detail about her fears of the of what the White House might do to President Obama in terms of his being a good father to his children, and in terms of, she certainly addressed the personal side of being President of the United States much better than I think any other first lady has done. And she has some good lines, like that being president doesn't really test one's character; it reveals one's character. I think that is certainly true with the president. While nobody, even President Obama, thinks he's been a perfect president, he's done many, many good things. Which have brought an increased measure of peace to the world, an increased measure of economic security to American citizens.
Well, don't you feel that the speeches last night were more human and more than the cold speeches from last week?
I apologize. I'm not hearing you.
I said, do you feel that the speeches last night were more human and had more warmth than the flat speeches from the people?
I apologize again. I'm not sure what you said, but I think that I tried to find a quiet room at the convention, and I found the room that's only relatively quiet.
Quiet room. Yeah. Can you hear me now? How about now? Is that better?
Yes, I can hear you now.
What I was saying is, do you feel that the the intimate and warmth from last night in the speeches compared to the flat, cold, you know, distant speeches from last week really is a major difference.
Yeah, I think these speeches really make a difference. They go to the heart of the criticisms of President Obama. There's the Republicans are doing a good job saying, well, you've done some good things, but can you really trust the guy? And I think this is about proving that people can really trust him. And and then the Republicans appeal to the cynicism that is so widespread in America. And I think that hearing the testimonials from individual delegates, some Republican speakers, some, you know, the governor of Rhode Island spoke. He's been elected to the U.S. Senate as a Republican.
Yeah.
He was elected governor of Rhode Island, an independent, not affiliated with either party. He's for President Obama. There's a firefighter who spoke, who had been a lifelong Republican, but he decided that the Republicans are just indifferent to the public sector in general, and there are numerous members of Congress who are women who spoke, giving women's perspectives on President Obama. He had Hispanic speakers, Black speakers, and they had caucuses for the disabled that I went to. They had caucuses for the veterans and military families. They had caucuses for small business owners, for rural people, for senior citizens. There were a good number of constituency-oriented groups where the president's campaign is making an effort to spread the word as to how these groups have benefited from the Obama administration. And the truth is, he's done a lot of things. You know, you look at graphs from of increases and decreases in the number of jobs in this country. And under in the first couple months of Bush's administration, the U.S. gained jobs, and then the next few months we lost a small number of jobs, and the number of jobs we lost each month throughout the Bush administration pretty much increased each month, not every single month, but the general trend was a dramatic increase in jobs lost every month under the Bush administration. And by the time Bush left office, there were a lot of jobs being lost each month. And Obama took office, and for the first couple months, it was like the Bush administration. At the end, where there were a lot of jobs lost, and then every month it started being fewer jobs being lost. And now I think for 28 consecutive months, there have been jobs gained. It's a total reversion. Of the pattern of the Bush administration. And the White House is very much aware there's been a stagnation in middle class incomes, and they're seeking policies to deal with that. Now, President Obama was the first president to cut the rate in Social Security taxes, which is Social Security taxes are the most regressive tax we have. Nobody pays tax on income over $107,000, and everybody under $107,000 pays the same thing, whether you're earning $106,000 or whether you're earning $5,000. But Obama was the first president to recognize the regressiveness of the tax and cut it all across the board. The Obama administration worked hard to save the automobile industry. The Obama administration worked hard to stop mortgage foreclosures. The Obama administration worked hard to stop the abuses of credit card companies. The Obama administration doubled the amount of money for student aid. The Obama administration raised the use of renewable energy sources in this country by 27%. You go on and on down the list, and it's a pretty impressive list of good things that benefit the average citizens that the Obama administration has been able to do.
Right, and that's without any help from the party.
Absolutely. Out of the speakers you saw last night, besides Bill Obama, who surprised you?
Am I surprised about the Republicans?
No. Out of the speakers last night who spoke, who really surprised you? Like, wow, now that's you just weren't expecting that speech or to be delivered with such enthusiasm or passion or energy. Was there any other speaker that really stood out?
I think Michelle Obama gave the best speech. I think Devil Patrick was very good as governor of Massachusetts. He was able to contrast the record of his own administration and the record of Governor Romney. Under Governor Romney, Romney talks a good game about how he's a businessman and he creates jobs. But when he was governor of Massachusetts was 47th in job creation on a per capita basis across the country. Under Devil Patrick, Massachusetts is now number 10. Under Michael Dukakis, I heard a speech given earlier in the day, the Progressive Democratic caucus at a church outside the convention. It was something similar to the job in Massachusetts was similar to what it was under Devil Patrick. So before Romney becomes president, Massachusetts is gaining a lot of jobs. After he becomes governor, Massachusetts gains a lot of jobs. While he's governor, there's no real job gain. It's a bad record. As Devil Patrick said, he's a lot more interested in holding the job than doing the job.
Right.
In Massachusetts, Romney needed to be taken seriously as a candidate for president. He needed to serve as either governor or U.S. senator. Ted Kennedy defeated him for U.S. senator, but he was able to get elected governor in 2002, 8 years after Ted Kennedy defeated him. But he flip-flopped all over the lot. They had clips of Ted Kennedy's life on the television, on the screen last night. And one of the clips they had was of the Romney-Kennedy debate, when they were both running for senator from Massachusetts. And Ted Kennedy told how Romney has adopted one Democratic liberal position after another. And Kennedy concluded, if this campaign goes on another 2 weeks, he'll probably announce he's voting for me. Such a liberal when he's running in Massachusetts. Now he's running as the most right-wing Republican candidate in the lifetime of just about all American citizens.
As
he's far to the right of Ronald Reagan. He's far to the right of George W. Bush. He's just off the charts. And, it's amazing that somebody professing these ideals of extreme conservatism. He wants to fight public school teachers. He said that he's against putting more teachers in the public schools because people are tired of big government. Even the conservative Republican governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, said he didn't think teachers in public schools count as a big government. And Walker disassociated himself from Romney's anti-teacher remarks.
Right.
So when a guy named like Scott Walker, who's a who's considered one of the most conservative governors in America, is saying that Romney is too far to the right. You know people got to be cautious about voting for Romney. Just saying, well, it doesn't make much difference. There's no difference between the parties. Anybody who thought Ronald Reagan was bad has seen nothing yet. Romney will be far worse.
Yeah, well, I want to thank you, Senator Mark Cohen, 21 years in the Pennsylvania Senate.
38.
38 years?
38.
Oh, my gracious.
38
you know,
years. 21 terms. I've been elected to. I'm running unopposed in the upcoming election, so I'm counting that as an election victory. Counting the time I'm running opposed, 21 times I've been elected. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
I want to thank you for taking the time with us. I know you are just, you're the man down there, so I guess that maybe can they do anything without you?
Can I do what?
Can they, Pennsylvania, do anything without you? I don't think so.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the compliment.
Well, thank you.
Thanks again for having me.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. We just dropped the call. That was the 415 calling.
That would be...
Just give them a call back. Tell them that they were on here.
Okay.
Well, we just got a history lesson from Senator Mark Cohen.
It's one of the greater legal and progressive minds.
38 years. We got all 38 years in the last 40 minutes.
I don't think, no, I mean, he has just had some.
I mean, what doesn't he know?
Brilliant.
what doesn't he know? I mean, we really had some extremely.
If you've read some of his issues, but he's covered everything from education to welfare reform to good government.
Right.
I mean, he's really one of the great state politicians in our country.
Well, I want to –
and for an important area as well, for Philadelphia. I mean, that's our former nation's capital.
Well, before we go into that, let me play you a little bit of something that I'd like to play, you know, maybe once or twice during the show. And this is – the Munsters. Do you know you have never seen Eddie Munster and Paul Ryan in the same place at the same time? They look like one, you know. You peek on his head? And we have on the phone right now a young lady from the left coast. Introduce yourself, young lady.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Michael, Mr. Lawson. My name is Melissa San Miguel, and I am a California at-large delegate to the DNC.
Well, you know what? We were talking about you. Christian is here also.
Oh, hello, Christian.
And, Christian, say hello.
Hi.
Did you hear him?
Yes, no. I did. Hi.
Well, we were talking about you before, just a little while ago, but we've been dropping calls and dropping blogs and dropping everything. I mean, it's been amazing. So tell us, why are you here as an at-large delegate?
Well, I'm here to represent California and represent other families that are similar to mine and communities that I come from. I'm a first-generation American. My parents immigrated from Peru, come from an urban, environment. I'm born and raised in San Francisco, California. So I'm here. I'm proud to represent all of those that from back home.
Well, when's the last time you were back in Peru?
Second Peruvian we met in 2 weeks from two opposite sides of the coast here.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Who's the other?
Were we not talking about
earlier? Oh, that's right. Roxana.
Yeah.
Right.
She, but it's just interesting that we have these two dynamic
right.
women on two opposite sides of the continent, and they're both from Peru.
Well, Melissa,
yes?
What are you're running around with who?
I'm running around with someone that has that I've read about, quite a bit in history books, that has been an inspiration to me and that I'm completely floored that I get to hang around with, and that's Miss Dolores Huerta. She's been an amazing person, and it's everything happens for a reason, and serendipity can hit at any moment. And I saw her again when I was checking into the hotel. She was the first face that I saw as soon as I turned around and got my room key. And I've been fortunate enough to spend quite a bit of time with her since arriving here to Charlotte, and really getting to learn from her and her experiences and just everything. And it's been quite amazing.
Well, I heard stories that she was a little energetic, let's say.
Last night. Dancing. I mean, she was dancing. Everybody, I've had three drinks and she was still dancing. And, I don't know what to do. What do you do to keep up with her? Or what can you do?
I don't know. I think at this point I've been trying coffee, and now I'm just running on adrenaline to keep up with Mrs. Huerta. She's, she can do it all. It's been quite amazing to be able to be in her presence and to watch her do both work. I went with her on my first day here to a house party to speak to some North Carolinian great women in South Park, and to get them to volunteer for the campaign, and so saw her in action and trying to get all of those women together to go out and volunteer. And then I see her as well, enjoying herself and having a great time, like she did and I did at the Black Caucus party last night.
Well, can you get, for those who don't know, can you give us a brief history of this this fabulous woman?
Sure. Ms. Huerta is from Bakersfield, California, which is a very small, and from a town right outside Bakersfield, actually, a very rural area in California. It's a farm working migrant community, and she, along with Cesar Chavez, organized the farm workers to start the United Farm Workers Union. Has marched in the fields, marched, in the Capitol, marched to Sacramento to, create rights and livable working conditions, not just for migrant farm workers, but for poor and working class people all over the country. And it's through her work. She's definitely one of the legends within the Latino community for all that, she has endured. She is a mother of several children. So as she, when she started organizing, I believe she was a mother of seven children at that point, a teacher, college educated, and thought it was so important to stop teaching and to start organizing the poor kids that she was teaching, because she saw that they didn't have any shoes. Some had, holes in their clothes, and she thought it was really important to help create livable conditions for them and their families.
Fantastic. Now, hey, Melissa, this is Thomas. I did not get to meet you last night, but I've heard many a thing about your great beauty and your great personality. But I would like to know about you and your story. Did you get involved in some?
Pardon me. What was the last thing that you said, sir?
Oh, I said I would like to know your story. How did you get involved in politics? Was it through people like this that you met, or was it something else?
It was being inspired and motivated by my family and by the neighborhood that I grew up in. Seeing my parents, both my parents immigrated to this country and didn't speak any English, and they left their families in Peru. We're a pretty small family here in the U.S., but very large back home, you know, where my parents are from. And seeing their struggles, you know, to raise a family here and to try to support my brother and my sister and I, and sacrificing so much, inspired me to want to be able to help others. My dad worked in the boiler room at a pretty famous hotel in San Francisco, and it's called the Fairmont Hotel. And, you know, he was always in the boiler room, the chiller room, taking care, going up and down the hotel, taking care of the guests, you know, if anything was happening with their ACs. And it's, you know, he used to work the swing shift, so I'd be fortunate enough to see him for a half hour in the morning before going to school. So, you know, I'd be in school, and then he'd be at work when I'd come back. And I saw my dad work really, really hard, and his work take a very physical toll on him as well. Like, now he's in his early 70s. He's retired, but he's you know, I can see what a life of such hard work has done. Like, he walks a lot slower. He's a bit hard of hearing, but, you know, he still manages to enjoy life. And seeing the sacrifices and the hard work that my parents did to try to provide my siblings and I with something better has motivated me to want to do that with others, because it's through their work and all their sacrifice that I've been able to live out my dream and, you know, go to college and live out what I'm experiencing right now here in Charlotte.
That's amazing. So that's an exact echo of Julian Castro's and Michelle Obama's stories last night, the things they were talking about, you know, what your family makes you and what your life creates in you that you then carry forward. I think the example they gave was a relay race where you take the baton and you run off. So you're
yes.
carrying up for your family.
Well, you know, and now we'll get into that, maybe not today, but tomorrow. The exact same thing was said by Dr. Chavez, Ben Chavez, who I met at the night of at Night Theater for the Friends of 50. He told me that same story. We're going to play that. It's about 15 minutes long, so not going to play it today. But you're absolutely right, Melissa. I mean, your story was a story. A real story, not a made-up story, to get sympathy.
No, it's a true story of America.
And what did you do when you were a kid and your father was working and your mother was working? How many brothers and sisters did you get?
I have an older brother and an older sister, so I'm the youngest one of the three. And,
baby.
Yeah, the baby of the family. My mom still calls me that too. she loves us very much, and she.
When did you realize your dream, and that you can step up, and that you can you know, be a voice?
When?
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
when did
hard,
I decide?
Much less.
I'm sorry, I couldn't catch the first part.
Well, when did you realize that you could go into a direction that where you could be or possibly be all you could be, or go into that direction?
I realized that in high school. I grew up in the Mission District in San Francisco, you know, which is a working class immigrant neighborhood. You can conduct your day, go about business, buy food, take care of anything, pretty much in Spanish, if you know all day. And unfortunately, though, growing up, there were a lot of gangs on the street corners, and my mom would make me take the bus, even though I could walk home. It was about a 10-minute walk, but she'd make me take the bus instead, which would add about 20 minutes, just so I wouldn't walk by all the gangbangers on the corners. And so when I went to high school all the way across town, to a public high school in this different neighborhood, a very different community, I was middle class, upper middle class, actually, rather affluent. And I saw the neighborhood was different. And, you know, it was a very college-going high school. I was already doing really well in school before then, and it just that type of environment helped facilitate my own college dream. Unfortunately,
yeah.
though, I saw a lot of my friends from the neighborhood, you know, still going to our neighborhood schools, and they weren't afforded the same opportunities that I was. I was able to take all these honors and AP classes that I wanted to take, and so sometimes they simply didn't have those classes available to them at their high school. And so it just, that experience when I was 14 years old, you know, going to this high school really got me to see that in my own, and I love San Francisco, but in my own town, we were, you know, different communities are having very different experiences about our daily lives. And it had a different outcome. You know, for me, I was able to go off to UC Berkeley and graduate there. And I did very well there as well. And it helped launch my life into a whole different trajectory. And so I think that for me, I've always realized how fortunate that I am to have had the opportunities presented to me. And I guess, especially being here in Charlotte and seeing the legends, you know, within those who have been working so hard and have dedicated their life to public service, has given me a sense that, like, I have a big sense of responsibility right now, that all that I'm experiencing and the stories that I get to hear from the trailblazers, you know, Latinos, African-American women who, you know, are in their 60s now, and back then when they were trying to, you know, promote equal opportunity for everyone, that I get to be in their presence and learn from them and use that as well.
Right. Well, you know, I thought, well, Christian spoke so highly of you. We had to have you on the show. And but people needed to hear, you're the same thing. Your exact story is the stories they were talking about last night. Everything.
Yes.
I mean, it's a story.
Yes.
And it's not the
story.
It was an American story. It's not the story where I had to, you know, I had tuna fish one time. I mean, you know.
Oh, I suffer.
Yeah. And tuna fish. I mean, that's what we heard out of
story
last week.
Working people.
Actually working people.
Yeah, who just try to live their lives step by step. And now they're able.
And you know, as I was listening on the floor to the speeches by Mayor Julian Castro and the First Lady, I was getting very emotional. You know, they're telling the story of my family, of my community, and it made me feel very fortunate that I'm right there, and very sad that, you know, a lot of friends aren't able to be there, that come from communities, that the ones that I do, you know, who are families that are just trying to make it, you know, just trying to survive. And so it was inspiring to me to see these two figures as inspirations that of those who have made it and who are really trying really hard to continue fighting for all of us.
Right.
And this also kind of echoes that theme, Michael, we talked about earlier. We played the interview earlier with the
young lady, Kelly
UAW
Harrison,
and everything.
From UAW, right.
you remember that union actually has. They're not just these monolithic organizations that make Republicans cry or something.
Right.
They actually help lives. They help communities, and they build this country up. Was your father in a union, Melissa, or was it just...
Yes, he was. He was part of the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 39. Now it's Local 3. And so I strongly believe in unions because I felt the positive impact of it. We were able to live in San Francisco. My parents still live there right now. And my dad, it's because my dad has a living wage. They can afford to still live there because my dad has a pension. You know, they're seniors. They're less mobile, and for them, it'd be really hard to have to leave and move somewhere else. As a kid, I remember I fractured my ankle playing soccer, and so I needed to have surgery to put a pin in it. And we had health care, you know, through the union and you know, the negotiation they had, you know, with the employer, with the hotel. I can't, like, now that I'm a lot older, you know, as a kid, I was just like, it felt very painful to go through it, you know, I was having to learn how to walk again on my right leg, but... I think now that I'm a lot older, I just look back and I wonder, like, what would have happened if we didn't have health insurance? It was already, you know, it was already financially tight for my parents to pay their portion, you know, that they had to, the copay. Had we had to have done it, I don't know what would have happened. I don't know. It may have been a different story.
Well, Melissa, what are you going to be doing now when you leave here this weekend?
When I leave here this weekend, when I go back to California, My sister is a teacher at our city college in San Francisco, and she teaches students who are at risk of dropping out of high school, so to build up their credits to be able to enter a community college. And she's asked me to come speak to her students and to talk about my experience here. And these students are from, you know, what she's told me about them, are survivors and warriors of life, you know, despite being under 18 already, you know, have endured health issues,
right,
gang issues, and all these different things. So I just want to share my story with them, but to help them see that, you know, different things are possible. But I think they're the heroes in all this, so I feel honored to be able to talk to them.
Yeah, well, it's so important to have a true example in front of the classroom. Mike and I both are teachers, and it's important. I'm telling you, it makes a world of difference. You can talk all day long, you can read something in a book, but when you see someone in the flesh, in the room, talking to you and telling the life story, whether it's, you know, Holocaust survivor or union worker or whatever, it actually changes lives. It makes a difference. So I appreciate you doing it. I really do.
Well,
and I want
to
thank you for meeting you. Yes, I want to thank Christy sitting right here. And we're going to let you go, because you have to, you know, you need to chase that young lady around and make sure you catch up with her. And please, get her secret of how she does it.
I'm going to try. I think she may keep it secret and hidden, but I'm going to try to figure out how to be such a lovely lady at her graceful age and still work and have fun and you know, be here always
dance.
To support.
And dance. She was putting people on the dance. Right. Okay,
yes.
Melissa, give us your name again and where you're from.
I'm Melissa San Miguel, and I'm from San Francisco, California.
Okay, Melissa San Miguel. And, oh, yeah, I was talking to Christian about this. You know, San Miguel is a famous beer in the Philippines.
Yes,
it is. I love it.
I was going to ask you, do you enjoy it?
Oh, please, I enjoy it. Oh.
Well, it seems like after this interview, maybe we can go grab one.
Well, no, you don't. I haven't found it. The only place you can get it is at what's the place out for you?
Yes.
Frugal McDougal. The only place that sells it.
We will buy you some of your namesake.
All right. Sounds great, sir.
Take care, Melissa.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
See, you know, I said, San Miguel. See, I told you she knew it.
She knew
all about it.
Yeah,
see?
That's a good
that's a good beer. See, she liked that. And I like it, too. But anyway, tell you what.
I think it might be time. I'm not sure, but
yes.
We've been here for quite a while playing with this little machine of yours.
Yeah.
But it might be time
for
us to go down and hunt some of those prairie dogs that my lovely, lovely delegate from Texas was telling me about yesterday.
The prairie dog?
The prairie dog pimps that only pop up at election time.
Oh,
you know,
right.
They live underground and they tunnel all year long.
Yes.
We might have to go hunting some at the convention. I'm just saying, Mike.
Well,
see who we could interview.
You think, huh? Well, what I'm going to do is, right now we have about another 5 minutes, so I just want to thank everybody for calling in today. I hope you were able to hear, because Skype, well, because of the thunderstorms and whatnot, and because of we're overloaded.
Yeah,
it's overloaded down here. The airways are overloaded, and the blog was overloaded. Anything coming through the air was overloaded, except we're not overloaded. We haven't had nothing to drink. Anyway, I want to thank Christian Snyder from the Left Coast via the East Coast. And
I appreciate it greatly for coming on. You've been a true gentleman. You've taught me a lot. You're actually you even brought us a senator that knew more than everyone, apparently.
Evidently.
But I appreciate your knowledge and your service.
And I am going to we're going to sign off and say we will be back Friday with a wrap of the convention. Oh, it's going to be big guns tonight.
Big guns.
Big guns, the big dogs in town.
Hey, Mr. Bill.
Okay. Everybody, I just want you to make sure that you listen. You listen to the speeches tonight because the big dog is going to be taking them out. And this has been The Last Word. Michael Lawson, goodbye.
On July 1st of this year, the interest rates on Stafford student loans, the same loans that many of you used to help pay for college, are set to double. And that means some hardworking students will be paying about $1,000 extra just to get their education. So I've called on Congress to prevent this from happening. What we've said is simple. Now is not the time to make school more expensive for our young people.
Oh, yeah. You should listen to the president. Or as I like to call him, the Preezy of the United Steezy. Things are heating up inside Congress's chambers behind all those closed doors. So the president made a few discreet calls across the aisle. He said, hey, let's get together on this one. Without an affordable Stafford loan, where can a student turn? The Pell Grant is a beautiful thing, but with college getting more expensive, is it enough by itself to satisfy all your collegiate needs? Oh, hell no.
Oh, hell no. If Congress doesn't act, it's the students who play. The right and left should join on this like Kim and Kanye.
Now, there's some in Congress who disagree. They say keeping the interest rate low isn't the way to help our students. They say we should be doing everything we can to pay down the national debt. Well, so long as it doesn't include taxing billionaires. But their position is that students just have to make this rate increase work. Frankly, I don't buy it.
The Barackness monster ain't buying it. We all know our legislative body is in the House tossing and turning late into the night. But still, Republicans disagree and could even filibuster. But if they do, the president said they're going to feel it, Buster.
The GOP is steady saying no, no, no. They should start something new to do like Tim Tebow.
The reason it's so important to keep down costs is so we keep college affordable.
And the president knows his stuff, y'all. That's why they call him the POTUS, which means person on top. What is it?
Jimmy, POTUS stands for President of the United States.
He's the POTUS with the most.
Let's keep the rates down on college loans.
Stop the loan you save may be your own. Yeah. Let's get it together and make our lives better. Cause the college degree is more than a few letters. If college don't rise, go ahead, find it.
It's how we slow jam the news.
Oh, yeah.
Give it up for President Barack Obama. Oh, stop it, Mike. More with the president when we get back. Come on back.